Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
Hey, everyone. It's Asten Herndon, political reporter for The New York Times. When I became a journalist, I made a promise to my readers, like the way that doctors take an oath to their patients. I committed to bringing the truth to light, no matter which party, business, organization, or person I'm reporting on. I have to be persistent. I have to do research, and I have to push back when someone tries to hide or spin the facts. And I know I'm going to write stories that both Democrats and Republicans don't like. But that's what The New York Times has been doing for more than a century, and that's what we're going to keep doing. We believe the public deserves the right to make up their mind based on the facts. So if you want to support this kind of work, you can subscribe to The New York Times at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your crashed hashtag of music news and criticism. I'm your host, John Garamonica. It's been another adventurous roller coaster week in the Stan fan political activism nexus. What you've seen over the last 3 weeks are different Standoms getting activated, whether organically on their own or sometimes in concert with the artists that they are supporting, to advocate for political causes. One of the myriad offshoots of the protests and activism in the wake of the killing of George Floyd. And there was something that happened about a week ago with the president, who held a rally in Tulsa and arrived at the rally to find that there were many, many seats that were empty, even though, according to the campaign, hundreds of thousands, potentially a million tickets had been quote unquote reserved. And very quickly after that realization that the arena was not full, people started taking credit. The Times wrote about this. Taylor Lorenz wrote about it. Folks on TikTok, in partnership with K-pop stans, spoke up and said that they had almost done a collective action to reserve tickets as a way of duping the Trump campaign into thinking all these people were interested in coming to this rally, when in fact it was a far, far smaller number of folks who actually came to the rally. Now, that tied in with some other acts of activism that came from K-pop stan groups. And again, this is all stuff that I have not interviewed K-pop fans about. I'm just telling you what the news headlines are. Crashing White Lives Matter hashtag and filling it with fan cam videos and other things to basically dilute hate messages, sending fan cam videos to apps created by police departments, which were designed to accept footage of basically protest behavior and looting behavior, but were crashed with footage of K-pop idols, and also raising money. And this was something that was true with BTS and the BTS fandom, which is called ARMY. You were listening to Euphoria by BTS at the beginning of the show. So there have been several iterations of the Stan activism nexus over the last few weeks. And it got me thinking more broadly about how do famous people tell their fans about their political beliefs? How do fans tell the artists that they are fans of that they want them to be engaged in social issues and political issues? And so on this week's podcast, I wanted to have a conversation with someone who thinks really hard about fan groups, K-pop, but also the Navy, Barbs, the Beehive, and many, many more. And so we're going to be talking to Denisha Kulor. Denisha runs a newsletter. It's called Stan. You can subscribe at astan.substack.com. And Denisha is someone who has been thinking about fan groups and Stan activity in a lot of different ways that, as I read her newsletter, were unexpected to me and were really exciting and really pushing the conversation around fandom forward. So to talk about politics and activism, Denisha is here. Denisha, what's good?
How are you? Thanks so much for having me.
I'm so glad you're here. I know you haven't specifically written about this K-pop moment, but the most recent iteration of your newsletter, the headline is "Your Favorite Celebrity Is Not Coming to Save You." Harsh. Yeah. but the entry is all about what famous people do in moments of, you know, political activism, and more crucially, what fan groups do in relation to what their heroes do or do not do. And that's the part of the dynamic that I found kind of most fascinating to jump on, which is to say it is possible for there to be some kind of disalignment between the famous person and the fan group. So let's touch on some moments where you feel that that was what was at play, because we've had so many, especially in the last 4 weeks, there have been so many opportunities for famous people to step in it, basically, and for fan armies to speak up either in support or in conflict with their heroes. So I wonder if you can talk through this a little bit more, this idea of separating the sentience of the fan group from the actions of the hero.
I think that there's a point in which the fan groups determine whether they're going to look at the artist as the kind of leader and person driving the charge in terms of how they show up and the ways in which they want to show up. And then there's a point where they realize that they can't look to X celebrity or X artist to be that person for them. And I think that when they hit that point of realizing, like, this person, right, is not coming to save me, It leads to all the emotions. But I think for some of my favorite fan groups, you also see it leading to action, right? And this concept of how fan groups thrive without the artist. And most times it's been explored through, like, death when an artist passes away. But more and more so, I think you're seeing it now with fan groups who are really disaligning themselves from the artist, but they've connected so much over this common thing that it's still the perfect grounds to work together on a common cause.
You and I had a conversation yesterday in a kind of in prep for this talk. And one thing that we discussed that I think really is potent, and I think people don't give enough attention to, which is if you are a fan, and especially if you're a stan, what's likely is that that artist is serving some kind of need for you at the moment where you decide to stan. But also, you will grow up, you will age, you will evolve, you might feel differently, and that artist may not serve that same purpose at this later part in your life. Do you feel that this, the kind of disaggregation of stan groups and heroes, do you feel that that has to do with stans aging out of their fandom, or does it have to do with artists doing things proactively or not doing things that are generating a response amongst active stans who still would like to stan if they can?
I was thinking about it a lot since we had that conversation, and also in reference, really, I think a great person to look at is Drake. And there's been more and more critique kind of whether or not Drake has continued to grow, right? And whether that's been impacted in his music. And the fans that started with him might not be the same fans or stans that are with him now. And you can tell that that's something that plagues him in a way. And so something I think that was super relevant.
Oh, it plagues him. Oh my Lord.
For sure.
I know you're right, though. So that's why I can't even be mad. I know you're right.
So actually, when during the Rap Radar interview, he talked a lot about kind of his frustration with not being seen or sometimes embraced as a Black artist. And when he makes these accomplishments that people never say that a Black man did that. And I just thought it was very interesting as a fan and at one point in my life, probably a stan of Drake, because I don't know if he, like, necessarily keeps that same energy all the time. And so I think with with his fans, he was forced to, you know, I wouldn't say forced because it was his own decision, but they ultimately encouraged him to donate, I think, what ended up being $100,000. But I think it's the force function of realizing, like, I feel like I've grown beyond this artist. And it's a hard force function to have to deal with as a fan. And I think it breeds some animosity as well during this time.
Top-down animosity or bottom-up animosity or both?
I think it's both, but I think really it's bottom-up animosity. I do think that for the artists, they are now realizing that, wow, like my relationship with my fans looks different and it's not what it used to be. And they have to really think about why that is. And at what point did that go left? And we talked about this concept of like the privilege that comes with celebrity. And sometimes to not always see artists acknowledge that and really conscientiously talk about that dynamic with their fans can be hard for everyone.
Drake's a particularly interesting case because Drake is someone who I think from the earliest stages of his career has always functioned with a symbiosis with his fans. He's understood that his fans take him in, they meme him, they take aspects of his personality and character and adopt them as part of their lives. So the Drake celebrity experience is not like, I don't know, like the Madonna celebrity experience of the 80s where it's just all this top-down content and all you can do is kind of gorge on it. With Drake, you constantly, you're using bits and pieces of Drake in your own life. But that's comfortable, right? Because if you're Drake, you know, oh, okay, I'm fitting into these millions and millions and millions of people's lives. But when those people's lives start demanding different things and they look at you and you're not providing what they need for that moment, then that's where the bonds get a little bit thinner.
Yeah, for sure. And I think interestingly enough with Drake too, is the feedback is really his silence. And the message that gave, like him just choosing to be silent on a lot of these things, and in comparison to his peers, right? The conversation of being one of the biggest artists is also going to come with a much larger critique and larger expectations. And in some ways, I think feeling like he didn't rise up to the occasion necessarily.
If you look at the rookie class that Drake was a part of, roughly speaking, compared to someone like J. Cole, who we did talk about in the other day, compared to someone like Cole, that wasn't Drake's lane to be engaged with politics or social issues. So to wake up in 2020 and be like, huh, okay, that's what's expected of me now, even though for X amount of years, I have not done that, or I've by and large let that go to the side. Drake, relatively speaking, is an artist who's flexible enough and alert enough, I think, to say, huh, okay, I can read the room, I can gather the moment, and I will respond accordingly. Whether that's enough for his fans, it's tough to say. At least he did nod in that direction.
I guess the question then that poses itself is thinking about J. Cole and kind of the tweets he did after releasing Snow on the Bluff is he kind of denounced people giving him this, right? People looking to him to be this woke rapper and the one that educated them and spoke about activism. It seemed like a title while he had embraced, wanted to in a way denounce because he felt like it was too much pressure.
J. Cole isn't someone who has always been a little bit reluctant to be fully in the spotlight for any reason. And that's vis-a-vis his press. And when I interviewed him, he talked a lot about the pressures that he felt when he was a young rapper to basically be a quote unquote big rapper with like almost like a capital R rapper, you know? And then he realized that that didn't suit him. It didn't suit his personality. You know, it didn't suit his lifestyle. And so he retreated from that. And I think when he retreated from that, part of what he retreated from, I think, is that kind of granular relationship with the fan group that had already aggregated around him. And those fans still stuck with him, even though he was kind of keeping his distance, broadly speaking. And I think he now hit a moment in 2020 with the Snow on the Bluff song and then the No Name response. He hit a moment where there was a misalignment again between where he had landed and where his fan group had maybe expected him to land. Just to make clear what we're talking about, let's listen to A Touch of Snow on the Bluff by J. Cole.
So when I see something that's valid, I listen, but it's just something about the queen's tone that's bothering me. She strike me as somebody blessed enough to grow up in conscious environment with parents that know about the struggle for liberation, and in turn they provided with a perspective and awareness of the system and a fairness that afflicts them, and the clearest understanding of what we got to do to get free, and the frustration that feels the worst seems to come from the fact that most people don't see. Just because you woke and I'm not, that this shit ain't no reason to talk like you better than me. How you gonna leave when you attacking the very same thing they really do need? This shit you saying, instead of Kavan,
you see the misalignment of fan groups, and people have chalked it up to cancel culture, which in my opinion, I don't necessarily always think is the right phrase. I think cancel culture has gotten such a negative connotation, when in reality, it feels like to me more of accountability culture. And I think it's okay for artists and fans to have misalignment and for fans to feel like they can hold those artists accountable in a way that isn't truly fully canceling them, but more of an understanding of where they are in their lives and how that correlates to your life as a fan, and whether there's product market fit, to be technical about it.
Product market. I do want to add, and I should add, because I didn't mention it at the top. So your Stan newsletter is your side hustle. You do have a day job. So you work, if I get this wrong, tell me, you work for Grasshopper Bank and you cover early stage tech. So you're out here in the tech and understanding all these terminologies that are probably from these other spaces, and also probably applying them back into your coverage of stands, I would assume.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think a lot about the artist as a startup, and I'm very lucky in my current role to work with startups. And so being able to see the similarities, and really in the early days, it's a lot of the same concepts and techniques that startups use to grow users that artists use to get fans. And I think just the way we interact with brands in general, regardless whether it's, you know, constituted towards a human or not, startups do with founders. Founders have the same type of fandom and are heralded. I mean, there are Jeff Bezos stands, right? And Steve Jobs stands. For sure, whether they want to admit it or not.
I don't know. We don't acknowledge those stand groups on podcasts. I don't know. I don't want to I'm probably going to get flooded with tweets now, but I'm unfamiliar with the Jeff Bezos stand group, but I guess I'm sure I'll hear about it after this.
Oh, I'm sure you will. And so it makes it interesting and kind of seeing how those concepts overlap. But I say all that to say, I think fans are frequently assessing and improving their feedback loops to make sure that they have product market fit.
Now, in this most recent newsletter entry, you had a very simple diagram that I think kind of captures the whole thing. Do you want to just explain it to people rather than, because they can't see it? So number one, subscribe to Stan. But before that, Denisha will explain this diagram.
Yeah. So I really wanted to touch on artist audience composition and how artist audience composition looks in the past compared to the present. So in the past, it really was this bottom-up approach with artists focused on casual listeners, the radio play, touching the masses, really, and kind of the fandom that came with people becoming casual listeners and then fans. And I think the concept of the stands were really served last, which is why artists were so politically correct. Now, though, and I think this is the path that all artists should take, it really does look like starting with stands first, right? Building super engaged fan bases who love you, not just for your music, but everything you embody, whether that's your fashion, your lifestyle, your beliefs, and that fandom really trickling down to casual listeners. And we were kind of talking about this with K-pop, right? I feel like there's so many ways in which I was truly not a big K-pop fan, and not because I didn't like the music, but I just didn't really listen. But you can't ignore the K-pop fandom, and it makes you interested. You can't ignore, I think, you know, that's where No Name wins. You can't ignore the amazing things that she's done. And it's a great entry point to then say, like, let me listen to her music.
I'm in my middle age now without dating myself. I am not, you know, I'm middle age. But I think about all the free labor that I gave to my music consumption when I was young, right? Standom didn't exist as a concept then, but I know I would have been a stan of some kind if such a thing was available to me at that time. And so I'm generally like very sympathetic to the energies that Stan armies put out in the world. I do think with the K-pop thing that's been happening, or maybe hasn't been happening, depending on which narrative you believe, in the last few weeks especially, what's really striking is I never thought of my fandom or my music engagement as a skill set. You know what I mean? I never thought of it as a tool when I was young. But I think in this, in the social media era and in this particular environment, this networked environment, that kind of fandom is also a translatable skill set.
Oh, totally. It's been fascinating in the sense that I think that one of the amazing things that's going on in our world right now is we're actively changing or defining what it means to be an activist, right? And realizing that everyone is an activist in different ways, and we all bring different skill sets to the table. And one of the most interesting things has been the ability of fan groups to use their skill sets and translate it into something else in a cause that they can all agree on. Some of the same techniques that they use to get their artists to number one or make sure that they sell out their merch are being used to promote what's going on in the world. And I think that's really, really cool. And even more so when it becomes a dialogue and you see artists embracing that work of their fandom. It's almost like leveraging the capabilities of your team to do something else.
Do you find K-pop stans to be differently organized in any particular way from, you know, the Navy, the Barbs, Beehive, etc.? Are there material differences?
Yeah, so one thing that's been really interesting to study is K-pop fans, while to me they're the most complex fandom so far, is they are very organized and very aligned. They do a good job of consolidating the network effects that they have under a unified strategy, which is something that I think a lot of fan groups could improve on. Or maybe not improve on when you think about the intersectionalities that come with being a stan. But I don't know if they have it published somewhere or what their ethos is, but they all seem very mission aligned and driven. And like K-pop stans have a good culture, a culture that they're unified around, and it shows in everything that they do.
Although it's interesting because obviously one of the things that you've seen in the last 2 weeks is first the emergent narrative of, you know, K-pop stands as an online army, no pun, but pun, but, you know, an online army now sort of gathering and mobilizing for political action or social action. But then there's been the pushback narrative, which is, hey, actually, stan culture historically is exclusionary and you know, certainly can be anti-Black, and especially in K-pop stan groups, which as someone that's been to all the K-cons, it's like I know perfectly well the diversity of K-pop fans in this country. And I've read a lot on Twitter about how sometimes the mobilization of these armies against Black fans who speak up and say, hey, actually, this thing that happened, that maybe is racist. Like, hey, this person, this performer should not be in blackface. And then they will get shut down by the stan armies who are mobilizing in kind of blind loyalty to the star. So there is this tension of, hey, this is a good thing that seems to be happening from a political perspective, but let's not paper over some of what's underlying this.
That's a great point. And I think that something people can sometimes forget about stan-dom is inherently, it's very hierarchical. And while I think stan-doms embrace new fans and, of course, new stans, it still is done in a hierarchical way that can be really difficult to deal with.
Within the stan.
Within the stan-dom.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, it is a very hierarchical in that way. And I think it's also a tension that artists balance because, being a fan for longer, spending more time or money or whatever it is, I think fans expect to be treated and somewhat compensated with an experience for such. I think what's interesting is when you do have this kind of internal battling within the stan-dom, it does a few things. And the first thing is it really brings forth this concept of like, intersectionality within stand-up and what that looks like, right? Because I think you can interact with an artist and want to be a stan, but there's some very specific things that they can do that can feel unique to your experience that's hurtful, right? Or that really does impact your ability to want to champion them. It's something, I mean, I felt with watching this kind of J. Cole and No Name situation unfold. I think even every woman in rap music, right? Or like there's things that you can love while also having a problem with, but there's becomes a point in stand-up, and this is one of the downfalls of stand-up, where it is, like you said, blind loyalty. Because of that blind loyalty, stans aren't even willing to have a conversation with folks, even if it's each other. And that's where things can be problematic for sure.
To circle back to the J. Cole and No Name thing, I'm curious because one of the things that was happening in that back and forth, and I think more with No Name than with J. Cole, is I felt that No Name presenting how she was presenting on Twitter was attracting a number of people to her who then said, huh, I'm going to get interested in No Name's music. I maybe was not totally up on No Name's music previously, but now this person who's speaking to me socially and politically, okay, I can get behind that. And that's not something we've always seen with, certainly not in the generation of fandom, it's not something we've always seen outside of sort of small cohorts.
Yeah, I mean, you saw that with Nipsey Hussle, I think was a really great example, and people really embracing the marathon mindset and him deciding to sell his album for $100. I think No Name is a really interesting and great example of the evolution of fandom and the role that artists play in it. I wrote an article about her a while back talking about cancel culture and how No Name's essentially built a framework as an artist to be cancel proof. And my belief that in why she's able to do that is because of her dedication and commitment to learning and iteration and kind of having strong beliefs that are loosely held, right? And you continue to see that in the evolution of her career, originally naming herself No Name Gypsy and realizing it was offensive and changing her name, or, you know, before talking about Black capitalism and realizing what the downsides, you know, of Black capitalism were, and taking time to educate herself and then also facilitating a forum for her fans to educate and learn, not just from her, but with her and in tandem with her. And so with the J. Cole specifically, the lack of, or what came off as a desire to not want to somewhat learn or try to get the right answers, and more of a fight for this is how I feel, I think made a lot of stans and fans feel unheard.
We've heard the J. Cole salvo, so we should take a second to listen to No Name's response. I mean, to be honest, we could probably listen to the whole thing, although I don't think we could play it that long. But it's called Song 33, and it is a very neat and effective dismantling of the J. Cole energy. But
dreams don't come cheap. I saw a demon on my shoulders looking like patriarchy, like scrubbing blood off the ceiling and bleaching another carpet. How my house get on it? Why Toya and body don't embody all the life she wanted? The baby just 19. I know I dream all black. I say not everything. Immortalized in tweets, all caps. They say they found her dead. One girl missing, another one go missing. One girl missing another, but new in the bag, quiet as a church mouse. Basement studio when duty calls to get the verse out. I guess the ego hurt now. It's time to go to work. Wow, look at him go. He really doubts to write about me when the world is in smokes, when it's people in trees, when George was begging for his mother saying he couldn't breathe. He thought to write about me. One girl missing another.
This podcast is supported by the Freedom From Religion Foundation.
I'm Ron Reagan, an unabashed atheist, and I'm alarmed by the intrusions of religion into our secular government. That's why I'm asking you to join the Freedom From Religion Foundation, the nation's largest and most effective organization of atheists and agnostics, working to keep state and church separate. Phone 1-800-335-4021, 1-800-335-4021, or visit the Freedom From Religion Foundation at ffrf.org. Ron Reagan, lifelong atheist, not afraid of burning in hell.
This is A.O. Scott. I'm a critic at the New York Times. What I do and what the other critics here do is part of the same project that all of the journalists at the New York Times work on every day, to give you clarity and perspective, and above all, a deeper understanding of the world. When you subscribe to the New York Times, it's not just here are the headlines, but here's the way everything fits together. If you'd like to subscribe, please go to nytimes.com/subscribe.
Now, I'm sure there are other artists who have made mistakes, made missteps, tried to hear the feedback and or heard the feedback and then tried to evolve. But I'm not sure that anybody else I would describe as cancel proof. There are people who've been canceled over and over again. So maybe I don't know, maybe that means they're a version of cancel proof. But it's interesting that you describe No Name in that way because of her open-earedness. And I wonder if you think that that is a strategy that can work for any artist, or is there something specific about how No Name deploys it that you think works for her, but maybe couldn't work for somebody else?
Yeah, so I think that it really is time and energy that folks and artists want to dedicate. And, you know, I think Cardi B does this really well as well, like realizing like we are going to learn together and this is what I'm going to do to help us learn together. I think that a lot of artists like saying like, I'm just a rapper, I'm just a singer. Don't come to me and don't look to me for this, and kind of in some ways shy away from the responsibility in some ways that they have to an audience. And so I don't think it's for every artist, unfortunately. And I do think that you then have artists that take such a vocal role, and a lot of people feel like they're silenced. And I think Jay-Z is a great example. And as a Jay-Z fan, sometimes it pains me to even somewhat be critical, but I'd be remiss if the way I think the deal with the NFL was approached didn't affect people, didn't affect how they looked at him as an artist and what their relationship was.
Also, a thing that I try to remind people of and return to again and again, as someone who has been a critic, like that's my job, has been a critic for my entire career. Criticism is not an act of dismissal. Criticism is an act of love. Criticism is an act of embrace. Criticism is saying, I take you seriously. I'm trying to meet you where you're at. I'm trying to learn where you're coming from. And I'm trying to share with you a perspective that maybe you haven't thought of or that might be additive in some way. It's interesting because I wouldn't necessarily have linked this kind of stan expectation shift to criticism before this conversation. But I do think there's something there in that these are both acts of dedication that also want to engage in a productive way.
Exactly. And to that point, it also begs a conversation of like, what are the platforms in which these criticisms are being given and how does the message sometimes get lost? And something I've been struggling with and thinking about, one, the conversation I think both fandoms are trying to have with their respective artists and looking at J. Cole and No Name, but also the conversation that fandoms are trying to have with each other. You know, a lot of this is on social media, and there's so much nuance to these conversations that social media feels like such a hard forum to really get to the bottom of that. Also because you don't really get insight into what level, with fandom being so hierarchical, what level of fandom you're talking to. I think that J. Cole stans and No Name stans can actually have a really great, really productive conversations. And I think there's actually more overlap between the highest forms of those fandoms in terms of people really being big fans of both. But it seems like such a hard conversation to have via Twitter, which is why it's just hard to keep it to 140 characters to fight, if you will, for your favorite artist.
Well, and that's ultimately the challenge. I mean, look, I try not to get nostalgic for the age of, you know, pre-Twitter, print magazine criticism and whatnot. But, you know, there was something to, hey, if you felt something, you would take time, you would fashion a text, whatever the text was, you'd work on it, you know, you'd spend a lot of energy on it, and it would take time to get out into the world and for people to read it and then have responses. But that time, even though it slowed the pace of discourse, what it also did is allowed you more space to really develop your ideas. And Twitter is a real challenge in that regard. And I'm always kind of grateful when I see a kind of an oasis of sanity on Twitter, even if it's coming from a place of, hey, I'm going to tell you something, or I want to talk to you about this. But if it's done with a kind of consideration and warmth, that's always great to see. But as you know, 80, 90% is not like that. Do you think from a Stan perspective, the immediate feedback loop of Twitter is ultimately a detriment because what it kind of encourages is the most immediately confrontational, pushy, sometimes negative version of the conversation? It's a chaos machine. It thrives on chaos. Do you think that's a detriment ultimately to Standom and then to artists?
I do, because I don't think that artists are able to truly effectively identify their stans on Twitter. And as a result, they group all the feedback, whether it's, you know, actionable or helpful, into basically like the same bucket as like haters or people that really don't know them as fans, and just denounce it, which I think really is tough because it's not always the fandom's fault. Like, you can only do so much to show J. Cole on Twitter you love him before you give him feedback. But it also invites people into the conversation in a way that like this might not, like, it's kind of family business sometimes, right? Like, and back to your point about criticism and criticizing from a place of love. I was reading Dear Sugar again by Cheryl Strayed, and some of the advice that she gave is like, when you have friends, like, only talk about your friends with people that love them just as much as you do. And that stuck to me a lot with like Standom, because I think that artists as a defense mechanism say like, y'all don't know what you're talking about. Like, I said what I said, it is what it is. When in reality, I think they'd be really open to understanding and having some of those conversations, but it just lacks nuance and the ability to really do that. And so they just denounce it completely.
It's like if somehow the tweets could be labeled with like, you know, J. Cole critique coming from J. Cole superstan, you know, or J. Cole critique coming from someone who doesn't care about it. It's like if you could have like a rating system that would somehow, or the tweet would be like red, green, or blue, depending on where it's coming from, you know, like
exactly.
there's no way to do that without digging through someone's entire feed to understand the fullness of their perspective.
Sometimes you look at these critiques and while they're interesting, it's like, wait, like, have you listened to J. Cole or do you understand what he believes in? Because this to me, while somewhat directionally accurate, seems a bit off the mark, and that sparks other conversation. And so, I mean, I think Twitter gets enough product suggestions, but in the event anyone's listening and wants to add it to the list.
It's almost like the sentiment analysis version of fake news, where is this article verified? You know, Facebook and Twitter are now labeling misinformation and things like that. Like, obviously, an opinion is not misinformation. Like, you can like something or dislike something, and that's fair game either way. But there is, like, almost like I said, like, maybe a sentiment analysis thing where you're like, huh, is this a hostility coming from a consistently hostile place? Is this hostility coming from a consistently positive place? Is this positive energy coming from a person with no followers and therefore maybe doesn't have any meaning? That might be an interesting way to enhance those Twitter conversations.
Yeah, and I think it would definitely move the dialogue forward.
In this entry, you gave a few examples of famous people and how they've engaged with recent political moments. And I wonder if you can talk about someone who you feel did it very effectively in terms of engaging with the political moment and also engaging their stans in the political moment.
So there's been a few people, I think, utilizing a ton of techniques, but the ones that really stood out to me, I think, on a bigger or smaller scale, is actually really Cardi B. I think she does a really great job of toggling between the dynamic of I'm a celebrity and I recognize I have this privilege, but I also am one of you guys, and this is why it's wrong. And so I think the first part is just being vocal, right? Feeling like you are aligned with what your favorite celebrity or artist is doing and that you guys are directionally aligned there. And then the second part, interestingly enough, and this is more so something No Name did well, is recognizing the different roles folks play in activism and tailoring your message to that. And I personally really liked when she donated, I think she donated $1,000. And rather than calling on her fans to match that donation, she asked for her celebrity peers to match that donation. And I think that was something that, you know, it was a really important thing in the sense of recognizing that her fans might, we're in a pandemic and unemployment is through
the roof. Right, I'm not going to ask a bunch of kids basically who probably are in school or working, you know, working entry level jobs. I'm not going to ask these kids to give up, you know, $100 of their salary for that. Yeah,
exactly. And I think John Boyega too. I feel myself creeping to becoming a John Boyega fan. In the sense that he, you know, is saying that he might not have a career after this, but it mattered to him that much. It was another really great example, in my opinion.
Well, it's interesting you bring up the John Boyega moment, and also in the context related to Cardi, because one thing that I think strikes me so much about Cardi is that even as Cardi has become more and more famous and more of an evident global superstar, she's obviously very much digital native. And I don't think she treats the internet radically differently now than she did 2 years ago, 3 years ago, 4 years ago. And I think because of that, the way that she engages with fans and also people who are dismissing her has this texture of truth to it. Because it's like she's still, for lack of a better perspective, she's still in the trenches. I mean, she's not. She's very rich. She's very famous. Presumably she's having a wonderful celebrity life, I hope. But the way that she communicates still feels very true to the texture of online communication. So I think when she says something that's politically focused or talking about the election or interviewing Bernie Sanders or whatever, it doesn't feel the same as if Drake did that or if Kanye did that or if Jay-Z did that or, you know, it feels like someone who is very much a proxy for the stan, a proxy for the person who's literally still online all the time doing that thing. And that's really powerful.
That's completely, completely true. Cardi is, in by all definitions, colloquial. Cardi continues to be colloquial and I think has no aspirations to change the colloquial feeling her fans have with her. Whereas I think others, and this is really interesting, like you look at how a Cardi B would navigate this situation in comparison to Jay-Z. And while I recognize people are probably listening to this, like, where is the comparison here? But you have Jay-Z, whose approach is to, you know, talk to the owners of the league, to, you know, go to the CEO.
I'm not a businessman. I'm a businessman.
Cardi is bottoms up. Jay has taken more of a top-down approach, and it definitely impacts how fans think about what to look to them for.
Jay's obviously much older and much more established than the Cardi. That's not to say that Cardi will not at some point adopt a different approach that's more like the approach that Jay is taking. But it is striking in this moment, this particularly intense moment, it's notable to see who essentially has the approval of the kids on the internet, right? And who is immediately perceived skeptically by those people. And I think the reason that Cardi has been so successful and still feels relatable is because she's still, like you said, colloquial. She's still deploying the vernacular of that space. And I think as long as she does that, it'll be very, very productive for her and sort of like very people's champ vibe for her.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting because I think we see the like progress of those feedback loops in real time. So even when Cardi might do something that fans aren't aligned with or have questions with or want to bring up, I feel like it's addressed in real time. Whereas a great example with Jay-Z is the title rollout. And I remember feeling like this is like a big celebrity press conference, like for the rich to get richer. And it wasn't until maybe a few years.
Well, I forgot about the press conference. I did go to an early like title big concert that was like maybe a benefit concert at Barclays, okay. I think. But I'd forgotten about the press conference and like how everybody was standing in that arc. Remember there was like a whole bunch of famous people. Who was it? Was it Jason?
There was
like
just
one
bizarre.
Country. Yeah, it was like one country guy, like maybe Jason Aldean, but also like Madonna and Rihanna. Like, I don't know.
Alicia
it was a very,
Keys and Rihanna and this video of them all coming together.
Everyone here is, you know, that term icons, but we all at one point were in love with music. You can't make it to where we what we've accomplished without having that love of music be the foundation.
In an interview, Jay-Z basically later referenced it that like he realized that that was a misstep. And the
oh, did he say that? Oh, wow.
Yeah, but I remember listening like, oh, wow. Like, didn't know you felt that way. Like, didn't know that you had taken this feedback and thought about it and recognized how it made your fans feel. And it was something that like stuck with me. And so it's just like, it allowed it to kind of fester in looking at like what that relationship looked like. And when you think of the crux of any good relationship, it is really looking at things in real time and addressing them. And because he's less participatory in the mediums that we are used to, it does allow things to fester sometimes.
Oh, absolutely. Do you feel and have you witnessed at any point when in your coverage or attention to Stan-dom, have you seen Stan groups splinter over politics or social issues?
Yeah, I mean, I think the best example is probably Kanye.
Oh, yeah.
And still have to say, yeah. I miss the old Kanye. But it's been fascinating, too, because the splintering is like three parts for me. I think you have the fans that are blindly loyal, right? And they have at one point said to themselves, I am following this artist anywhere, regardless. And my allegiance is to the artist, regardless of whether I agree or disagree with something an artist might do. Then you have fans that blatantly disagree, right? And they cannot support and splinter because they disagree. And then you have the fans that agree. And it's interesting because you would think the fans that agree would be in direct alignment with the fans that are blindly following. But in reality, no. And you see it in the dialogue because their feedback, a fan that's blindly following, their argument is, well, Kanye is Kanye. Whereas a fan that agrees is now arguing about this is why it actually makes sense for the topic at hand. And so I think it causes the fan groups to go in directions that are even more splintered than they originally expected.
And do you think those fan groups can ever recover their wholeness? Or does that one moment of political, you know, disagreement or misalignment, does that basically doom the fan group? Even more so than, hey, I put out a bad record, and maybe that dooms the fan group.
I think it dooms the fan group more than a bad record or a bad decision. And I mean, I wouldn't call myself a Kanye stan just because I know how active that fandom is. And I probably don't qualify, but yeah.
and still is despite everything. And still
exactly.
Is.
And I remember like having a bit of an issue realizing Kanye and Drake, right? Like that beef and where I felt like they fell, but I also saw a lot of truth in a lot of the things Kanye said, and for better or worse, sided with him. It's interesting in the sense that I think that the fans, it's really intersectional. And that's something that artists aren't thinking about. And the only thing I think worse than like no fans is a former stan breaking away. Because when they break away, it's not, oh, I don't listen to that artist. It's, oh, I don't listen to that artist and here's why. Oh, don't play that artist around me. Oh, I'm blocking that artist from playlists. I do not want to hear them. And I think they should suffer consequences. And so I think it's irreparable damage.
Do you think that dynamic is more present, like as we go on year after year after year, does that dynamic become more and more present? Because I can't really remember, you know, I mean, in the 80s or 90s, there being vocal anti-stans, you know, or post-stan or whatever we're going to call it. I don't remember that energy being a thing, but I do feel like I see it quite a bit. Do you think that that's increasingly part of the dynamic because of the systems by which fans attach and detach themselves from their heroes?
Yeah, I do. And it's interesting because fans are keeping score, but I feel like they keep score because the fans in a lot of ways are the new kingmakers, right? Kingmakers before was the industry, the folks at the label. But fans feel, and in a lot of ways, very much are the kingmakers. And so as a result, it feels very personal to, in a sense, disrespect them. So I think that part of it is like when you do propel this person as part of your ego, it's almost like venture. You have investors champion a company to the very end because at the end of the day, they invested in them. And
right.
The company going bad signals on that investment. So I think that's what fans struggle with in that dynamic, and also why it sometimes takes so long to denounce them. But when they do, they feel like they have to very actively do it and kind of say, like, this is how the artist strayed away from the product market fit that they had, from the thing that we originally became a fan from. And this is really where they're lost. And you see that down to examples and posts and very active outreach to bring people on to their cause now, which is against this artist.
Maybe let's hear a minute of I Love Kanye in memory of an older Kanye, and also in memory of Kanye's awareness of an older Kanye.
I miss the old Kanye, straight from the gold Kanye, chop up the soul Kanye, set on his goals Kanye. I hate the new Kanye, the bad mood Kanye, the always rude Kanye, spazzing the news Kanye. I miss the sweet Kanye, chop up the beats Kanye. I gotta say, at that time I'd like to meet Kanye. See, I invented Kanye, it wasn't any Kanye's, and now I look and look around.
As we close out the conversation, is there any artist that you either would like to announce a low-key stand-up for, or alternately publicly denounce for the first time
and
get rid of? It's well, an open floor.
That is a great question, and no pressure. I will say
no pressure.
These are artists that, or one that I'm, this is a very fluid stand-up relationship, but really learning a lot about what it means to go back and forth is actually a Burna Boy. So I'm first generation Ghanaian American, and Burna's desire to unite Africa has been great. And I think not without challenges, maybe in sometimes his approach and how he does it. It's a conversation for me and learning about like Africa and what Africa means to me and what like being first generation means to me. And so sometimes I'm like learning through my stand-up, my relationship with Africa. And so Burna Boy is definitely one that's been fun and interesting to stand. And I also consider myself a no-name stan. I will say I was and still am, much to your point about critique, I'm back battling myself to not to denounce myself as a J. Cole stan. And it might just be because my feelings are hurt, but I don't know. So I feel like J. Cole and I are at a crossroads.
You're taking a break. You're taking a break.
I'm taking a break, which hurts, but I'm taking a break.
Pick a Burna Boy song for us to go out on.
He just released a new song today called Wonderful, and it's great. So the new song? Yeah.
Denisha Cooler, appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me. And if you guys are interested, you can follow Stan at stan.substack.com.
That's right. Get subscribe and like. Jesus.
Thank you.
Of course. This week's JC Cribs should probably also talk about fandom. Now, like I said during the episode, I'm sure when I was young, if stan activity was an available thing for me, I'm sure I would have found a way into it. But it wasn't really like that. I don't know if my dedication took on traditional stan forms when I was younger. But there have been people over the course of my life who I have had kind of extreme interest in and extreme passion for their music and their presentation. And obviously, as you get older, maybe sometimes that lessens a little bit. But I do think I want to draw attention to someone who, as an adult, I have had just a tremendous amount of interest and excitement about. And that person is Cameron. Of course it's Cameron. How could it not be Cameron? Anybody who was with me during the Purple Haze era, you know what it is. You already know. Basically, the way I decided to talk about Cameron is I sort of turned my chair around and I was like, well, who do I see the most things of, the most items, the most ephemera? And there is a lot of Cameron ephemera in this room right now. So let's start by looking at the box of Killa Crunch, which is a cereal box. I don't think there's cereal in it. Can't remember, but I don't think there's cereal in it. But we have the Killa Crunch box. I've got a painting of Cameron when he was on, I believe it was the Bill O'Reilly show, the You Mad Doggy, the I Got Dirt on You Doggy. I'm pretty sure that's this episode. That's by the homie Christofferson San Pablo. Shout out to Christofferson. So I've got a painting of that moment, Cam wagging his finger with the Utah Jazz jersey. Up on the top of my bookshelf in the pink camouflage sneaker box, there's the Cameron Ventilators or Ventilator Supremes. I gotta be honest, I do not find these shoes aesthetically appealing, but I do love the color choices. So I have a pair just because it seemed like a thing that I would want to have in my home, obviously. Duh. So I've got that shoebox. Maybe the shoebox is low-key better than the sneakers, but we'll just, you know, we'll let it be. And then on my wall, and I see it, it's not directly in front of my desk. It's just to the left. But as I'm leaning in to my podcast microphone, I look up. What I see on the wall is the Cameron Purple Haze Black Light poster framed, gifted to me by a good friend, and now has a permanent place in my home office and in my emotional life. Cameron was someone who is sort of an astonishingly good rapper, also something of kind of a aesthetic surrealist in moments. And Purple Haze to me is an album that, you know, maybe it's aged a little less well than I would like to think, but in the big picture, it's a very, very impressive, unusual rap record that is just sort of bracingly bright, very, very intricate, flamboyant, and also very heady. And it's just obvious, it just speaks to me on so many different levels. And I think the sheer amount of Cameron ephemera in my home office, and also my personal predilection for the colors purple and pink. I do have a purple leather couch, just putting that out there. My personal predilections for those colors are, I'm sure, in some way connected to the peak Cameron era of purple and pink. So that's today's JC Cribs. Thank you for listening to this episode of Popcast. Thank you to Denisha Kulor for calling in. Listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/popcast. Subscribe to Popcast anywhere you get your audio content, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, et cetera, et cetera. Email us, popcastnytimes.com. I'm curious if you have any Stan activism experiences that you want to share, or get on the Facebook group and talk about it, because I'm sure, judging by the energy that I see on the Facebook group, I'm sure there's some Stan action in there, sometimes about people who appear on Popcast. FYI. Our producer, as always, is Pedro Rosado from Head Stepper Media. Let's go out with Lil Cameron from Purple Haze. It's hard to choose just one moment from one song from an album that's this much of a masterpiece, but you can never go wrong with Get 'Em Girls.
Killer. Let's go. I get the boosters boosting, I get computers puting. Y'all get shot at, for me, I do the... I do the recruiting, I tutor the students, I nurture they brain, I'm moving the movement. Kill em. Be the
there it is.
Who doesn't love a classic chocolate chip cookie? Famous Amos has been making them since the 70s, 1975 to be exact. With semi-sweet chocolate chips and a satisfying crunch, it's everything classic in one bite-sized cookie, and fans couldn't get enough. That's right. You'll find our original recipe, the one you know and love, in every bag of Famous Amos original chocolate chip cookies. Find Famous Amos anywhere you buy your favorite snacks.